All right, council, while you're getting prepared and other councils vacating council table, let me call the case. This is Hammond Construction versus Colorado Department of Transportation, Hammond Contractors, I beg your pardon. This case is set for 15 minutes per side, sorry. Okay, thank you. Council, are president ready in that case?
Yes, sir.
All right, go ahead and take your seat. When we're ready, we'll proceed. Let me just give you a brief overview of procedures here. The case is set for 15 minutes per side. You'll be guided by a lighting system on the podium that works as follows. When your time starts, the green light comes on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light comes on. And when full 15 minutes have expired, the red light comes on, which signals that you need to conclude your argument. There's a timing clock on the podium that counts backwards from 15, so you know how much time you've got left. The appellant may reserve whatever part of the 15 minutes you wish for rebuttal. If you want to give me some time that you want to reserve, I'll try and notify you, but the lighting system is your primary guide there. We've read the briefs in your case. We're familiar with the facts as you've set them forth, so to the extent you want to proceed directly to your legal argument and avoid discussing the facts, that's fine with us. But the case is yours to argue as you wish. We would ask you to stay close to the podium, please. We're recording your arguments. If you step away from the podium, your voice will not be picked up well. You should also be aware that the arguments are available over the internet within several days following today's argument. So if there's sensitive information that you don't want out in the public domain, be guided accordingly. If anybody in the audience has a cell phone or a pager, please ensure it's turned off. We're ready for argument.
Please the court, Jesse Witt for Appellant Hammond Contractors, or Hammond. Given the court's familiarity, I'll address the facts only briefly. As the court will recall, this case arises from a dispute over rock excavation on a Colorado Department of Transportation project, or CDOT project. Hammond filed a claim as a general contractor in 2003, demanding payment from CDOT for excavating rock that was not shown on CDOT's plans or included in its bid package. The claim went through several tiers of administrative review over a period of about 3 years, culminating in a confidential settlement offer from CDOT. That offer was rejected, and Hammond then filed suit, as it was entitled to do under its contract, seeking payment for the rock excavation that it had performed. The primary issue here is whether the trial court erred in ruling that Hammond had not submitted that rock excavation claim to the alternative dispute resolution, or ADR, process that was required by its contract, and that the trial court therefore lacked jurisdiction. In the trial court, CDOT argued that the theories in Hammond's administrative claim package had not tied out with the same labels that Hammond had used in its complaint in court, and that the case should therefore be dismissed. The trial court granted that motion without ever conducting a hearing or determining what was actually submitted to the ADR process. Under Worth, Trinity, and the various cases from this court and the Supreme Court that have addressed Rule 12b-1, it is clear that an evidentiary hearing is required in those situations where there are disputed questions of fact. That is so because a Rule 12b-1 motion, unlike Rule 12b-5 or Rule 56 motion, does not have the same procedural safeguards. A party cannot typically occurs at the beginning of the case. The court is not required to draw inferences in the plaintiff's favor, and based on that, the courts have made clear that there needs to be an adequate factual record and the opportunity to present evidence in a hearing. Now, CDOT has argued that a hearing was unnecessary because there was only documentary evidence and undisputed facts. The record conflicts with that and shows that's simply not true. Clearly, there were disputed facts about what claims had actually been submitted to the arbitration, or to the non-binding arbitration that functioned as the settlement administrative process. Now, there were questions concerning what theories had gone on there. CDOT submitted an affidavit from one of its engineers, which was silent on the remaining legal theories in Hammond's claim, but only mentioned a differing site condition theory. Hammond never had the opportunity to cross-examine that witness, Hammond never had the opportunity to call its own witnesses, to introduce testimony, otherwise prove up a record of what was actually presented in the administrative non-binding arbitration proceeding. And when submitted a minimum, the matter needs to be remanded to complete the factual record on that and determine what was actually submitted to the administrative process. In a brief, Hammond notes that in addition, the existing record also shows that, or is sufficient to show, that Hammond did in fact submit its claims to ADR, and Hammond will therefore ask that this court reverse the trial court's finding that the claims were not submitted to ADR and simply remand this matter for a trial on the merits. CDOT has argued that Hammond's case should be dismissed because the verbiage in its administrative claim did not tie out exactly with the labels in its complaint in court, but that's not the proper standard. CDOT's contract with Hammond required Hammond to state the legal and contractual basis of its claim and identify the pertinent facts. Hammond clearly did that in its claim letters, noting that it had a claim for breach of implied design warranty, cited several federal cases and general contracting law that indicate that the owner remains responsible for undisclosed issues in the plans. Hammond also cited the differing site condition provision of its contract, including set forth the legal and contractual basis, and it included an extensive recitation of the facts in which the unexpected rock was found and the party's efforts to deal with that. Likewise, when Hammond got to court under general pleading standards, Rule 8, as well as the City and County of Denver case, it is sufficient for a plaintiff to set forth the general facts that give rise and give notice of the transaction at issue. Hammond clearly did that here. It was very apparent in its complaint that it was seeking recovery for breach of contract based on the discovery of rock that was not shown at the plant, that was not shown on the original bid package, and that CDOT was in breach of its contract by failing to pay for that after Hammond performed
the work. What is the normal contracting process? I take it Hammond was not requested to bid a price for removing rock.
Correct.
Now, if they had been asked to do that, in addition to normal earth moving or excavation, if they'd encountered rock, then they could have removed the rock under their bid for the rate that they were going to do that at?
Essentially, yes.
And that would make it within the contract?
Yes. If the item had been included on there, Hammond would have been. It would have bid it accordingly. The way this contract was structured, it was based on a certain amount of information, but there's a differing site condition clause, which is a creature that arose from federal contracting to kind of take some of the guesswork out of bidding a project like this. And it essentially provides that the contractor is to go ahead with the work if a differing site condition is found, and that he can seek payment for it under appropriate remedies, which is the whole administrative claim that Hammond prosecuted here between 2003 and 2006. And again, at the end of that process.
So having the item bid, say it'll cost $10 a cubic yard to move the dirt, but if it's rock, it'll cost $30 a cubic yard or ton or whatever the measurement is. You at least have a price. The only difference is you have a price for the rock removal in the second contract and you don't in the first?
I think that is essentially true. The problem that occurred factually on this job is that the cost of removing the rock was much, much higher than what was allowed for in the bid. The bid had assumed essentially you were dealing with soft earthwork,
right,
would remove it with scrapers. As it was, they had to do a very labor-intensive process, dig it out, haul it off on trucks. And so I think the answer to your question is yes, that it would have been.
You might still have to go through the administrative procedure, even if you bid rock removal.
If there had been a different quantity or something, certainly yes. As it was, there was simply nothing in the contract at all for rock excavation, at least that required the use of rippers, which is how the contract defined the difference. If you have to use rippers, which are essentially hooks on the back of a bulldozer or a blade, at that point, that's a separate line item, and that was never bid.
Does the contract require that a specific legal analysis be set forth in the claim? You previously have mentioned, and I believe the contract term mentions, that you have to recite the terms of the contract that you contend allow your claim, correct?
I believe the pertinent specification states that there's really only about one sentence in there. It states the legal and contractual basis of the claim and the facts that give rise to it, or something along those lines.
So it invites you to categorize the type of claim as a breach of contract, breach of implied warranty, equitable adjustment type of claim, does it not?
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree that it invites you to categorize it. I think it states that you have to present some basis in the contract as to what that why you're legally entitled to seek relief. However, it never indicates that you have to elect a remedy or suggests that you can't allege several alternative theories, as Hammond did here, just stating that, for example, that there was a breach of an implied term of design warranty. There was also a breach of the specification, express specification term requiring payment, as well as equitable principles such as quantum merit.
So your position is that simply the differing site condition contention is enough to raise all of these kinds of legal theories?
Possibly, although that's not what happened here. In this case, Hammond raised all of those theories. It clearly referenced the United States versus Spearin, a seminal case from the United States Supreme Court that establishes the implied warranty of design that an owner gives to any contractor. Hammond specifically referenced the differing site condition clause. So certainly as to those two, it was very expressed that Hammond did do that. In the abstract, I would think that simply stating that under our contract we're due to be paid for rock that we removed would at a minimum suffice, but that's not, Hammond gave a lot more detail than that here. Just to touch very briefly on the additional points in Hammond's brief, even if the court were to affirm the first dismissal order, which stated that these legal theories had not been submitted to ADR, we would ask that the trial court's second dismissal order be reversed. The orders are mutually exclusive. The trial court's first order was based on the finding that Hammond had only submitted this equitable adjustment theory to the administrative claim process, whereas the second order came back and said Hammond did not submit the equitable adjustment theory to ADR. Those two orders cannot stand together. One of those, we would submit, needs to be reversed. And the final point I'd note is that as the recent New Design case, which arose from the same project, illustrates, the alleged failure to comply with contractual ADR provisions such as this does not deprive the trial court of jurisdiction, and we believe that on a remand, if any issues arise as to compliance with this provision, it should be addressed under Rule 12b-5 as the division in New Design ruled. And with that, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Skippery Spear. My registration number is 32061. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Colorado Department of Transportation. I think this appeal can be narrowed down to two issues. First, whether the failure to exhaust non-binding ADR constitutes a subject matter jurisdiction defect. And second, whether Hammond failed to exhaust the ADR in this matter. I really believe that the first issue can be decided based on three Colorado Supreme Court decisions. I also believe the second issue can be decided based on a handful of documents, approximately five documents. I'll start with the first question. In 1975, the Supreme Court decided Guthrie v. Barta. And that case involved a binding arbitration agreement entered into prior to the enactment of the Colorado Uniform Arbitration Act. The plaintiff failed to comply with that agreement, and the trial court dismissed based on Rule 12b-1 for a lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The Court of Appeals reversed, holding that the proper analysis was to treat that as an affirmative affirmative defense, and address it under Rule 12b-5 or Rule 56, as Hammond contends the New Design Court requires. However, the Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals and held the trial court had conducted the correct analysis. So the question is whether the rule in Guthrie v. Barta applies as well to non-binding arbitration and non-binding ADR. And I believe the answer to that is yes, based on two later Supreme Court decisions. In 1992, the Supreme Court decided Jefferson County School District number R1 versus Shorey. In that case involved an ADR proceeding almost identical to the one here, multi-tiered administrative review followed by arbitration, all of which was non-binding. There, the plaintiff requested arbitration, and the defendant denied the request. Plaintiff then filed a lawsuit seeking money damages as well as to compel arbitration. Court of Appeals ruled that non-binding arbitration must be pursued pursuant to the Colorado Uniform Arbitration Act and stayed the litigation claims. The Supreme Court affirmed. And the importance of that case is it puts binding and non-binding arbitration on the same footing.
So what was not completed here in the arbitration process?
It's my contention, CDOT's contention, that Hammond only submitted a differing site condition claim through the ADR process. And CDOT concedes that Hammond exhausted ADR in its entirety in relation to the differing site condition claim. However, it's CDOT's position that litigation claims are different from the differing site condition claim. And that relates to the second question of whether or not...
So it's your position that Hammond should have submitted a breach of contract claim to the arbitration proceeding?
It should have submitted it to the ADR proceeding, exhausted all of the ADR in relation to a breach of contract claim, if it wished to preserve that claim for litigation.
Well, what is the principal difference between a breach of contract claim and what was submitted to ADR? That is, that there was an unforeseen project problem that caused additional expense, and they asked for payment and you refused to pay. That sounds like a breach of contract claim to me.
A differing site condition claim has evolved through federal case law, construction case law, over the years, and it's a recognized equitable adjustment claim. And there's three cases in the record that you can review for that point. One of the best might be Bruner and O'Connor on construction law, which really collects all the federal court of claims cases regarding the issue. And that appears in CDOT's reply in support of its second motion to dismiss. However, just in the arbitration briefs, there's the URS case versus Tetra Tech FW, as well as the MA DLT construction case, which was cited in Hammond's reply brief. And those cases hold that a differing site condition claim is one for equitable adjustment, as opposed to, for instance, a breach of contract claim or an unjust enrichment claim. And if you look at the URS case, it actually separates out those three claims.
Let me ask you this, and go into the contract, 105.17, I think is the contractual provision we're relying on that requires the filing of a claim.
Yes,
you have to state the basis and support for the claim. The claim, as I interpret, is a claim we hit unexpected rock. We had to rip it instead of scraping it, I guess, and we want $277,000. Is there one claim, or they have to file five claims under your theory? They have to say claim number one, breach of contract; claim number two, equitable adjustment; claim number three, implied warranty. Is that what is you saying? They have to file basically three or four claims if they have four legal theories that they're relying on?
Yes, Your Honor, and let me explain why, if I may. 105.17c provides for a notice of intent to file a claim, which must set forth the legal basis of the claim. 105.17d sets forth the filing of a certified claim, which must set forth the claim in sufficient detail for the engineer to understand it, must contain specific cites to the contract referencing what portions of it support the claim, and it must be complete and final. Both of those documents are contained in Hammond's claim package, which is an addendum to the opening brief. Now, 105.17b further requires that whatever claims are submitted be exhausted through ADR, or otherwise there no further remedy is allowed. And in this case, the notice of intent to file claim sets forth the legal basis as a differing site condition. The actual certified claim states that CDOT is liable for additional compensation based on a differing site condition and cites to Standard Specification 104.02, which is the differing site condition specification.
So why does a differing site condition encompass all of these things? Is it because it has attained a legal term of art? Differing site condition means something special in the construction industry?
It's based on this differing site condition claim specification, which is actually required in all construction contracts that have federal funding included. In this particular case, it's a federal acquisition regulation which requires it to be included in CDOT's contracts.
Aren't the factual disputes, the evidence, and the measure of damage identical regardless of whether you call it a change site condition or a breach of contract or an unjust enrichment or an equitable adjustment claim? You're going to... The evidence isn't going to change. The measure of damages doesn't change. Why do you have to specify all these different claims in the ADR proceeding?
Yeah. And that's a good point, Your Honor. The reason that 105.17 is set up the way it is so that engineers and not lawyers or judges can decide these cases. Engineers need to understand what they're dealing with and how to respond to that. And if you look at the ADR record here, if you look at the, excuse me, the project engineer's decision and the regional transportation director's decision in ADR, being engineers, they took this claim and they said, oh, it's a differing site condition claim pursuant to standard specification 104.02, as Hammond stated in its claim package. Now, importantly, Hammond appealed both those decisions, but it never stated no project engineer, no regional transportation director. You both missed claims. We had additional claims that you didn't address herein.
I'm still kind of stuck, though. How many claims? They have a singular claim, it seems to me, for $280,000, let's say, and they say we're entitled, under the contract, it's clearly under the contract, we're entitled to $280,000 because we hit rock we didn't expect. And there were a variety of reasons, maybe unjust enrichment, it may be a breach of contract, maybe a breach of implied warranty design. But those are cause of action or legal theories. Their claim, it seems to me, is a singular claim, is it not? I'm stuck on how one claim becomes four claims because later on they put four legal labels on a judicial complaint. Can you help me with that?
Yeah. Differing site condition claims have specific elements to them. Those are set forth in the cases I cited, including the URS case, which include information beyond what's just in the contract. The basic elements are, well, what information is included in the contract compared to what did you actually encounter? However, it also includes all reasonable information that was available to the contractor, such as boring logs and geotechnical information that isn't necessarily a part of the contract. So therefore, I don't think it can be considered just a breach of contract claim. It's really this individual claim that the federal courts have created over many years to address the differing site conditions on public construction contracts.
If the ADR process is going to be decided by engineers, and we don't want to confuse them with a lot of legal gobbledygook, why would you make a breach of contract claim and all of that, that has its own separate elements, its own standards, why would you want those claims made? They would just disregard them, would they not?
Well, we want those claims made pursuant to 105.17C, which requires the legal basis to be set forth, so that the engineers can address them. And I don't think it's necessarily fair to say that state public engineers are going to ignore a contractor's claim. I think they'll do their best to address them. And by addressing them early and immediately when the dispute arises, it gives the parties a real opportunity to settle the dispute prior to it going to litigation.
You rely to a significant amount, it seems to me, on a group of federal cases deciding, I gather, federal contracts.
Yes.
Isn't that a whole unique and different kettle of fish than what we deal with?
Not when the differing site condition clause is the same clause on all highway construction contracts that's required by the federal acquisition.
Well, I know that, but the federal claim system is entirely different, and if I understand correctly, quite a bit more complicated.
Yeah.
And so court rulings that you seem to be relying upon wouldn't necessarily apply in this arena, would it?
Well, I guess I'm a little confused as to your question, Your Honor, as to are you referring to federal ADR proceedings? Okay, and then I can answer that.
Yes. For the record, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Then I would go back to my original point that it's really these three Colorado Supreme Court decisions that can be relied on to show that the failure to exhaust non-binding ADR is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. And I believe I left off with Guthrie v. Barda and then went to the 1992 decision in Jefferson County School District number R1 versus Shorey, which involved an almost identical ADR proceeding to that at issue here. And in that case, the Supreme Court ruled that litigation has to be stayed in favor of non-binding ADR. And the importance of that case is it puts both binding and non-binding arbitration on the same footing. And that leads us to the third case, which is the 1997 decision in City and County of Denver, which is an important case to this matter. Although it involved a different type of ADR process, the Supreme Court ruled that the failure to exhaust that process required dismissal. It also stated Colorado's strong public policy in favor of all ADR proceedings and stated that ADR clauses should be enforced as written. And what's important here is CDOT does have a rather specific ADR clause, although it's very similar to the one at issue in the Jefferson County School District v. Shorey. It also contains these clauses talking about asserting the legal basis of the claim and requiring exhaustion or that all other remedies are therefore precluded.
Let me ask you about, since you're on City and County of Denver, and you're talking about it on your first point, I guess, it's a B1 instead of a B5. Is that what you're...
Yes.
Let me ask on your second point, though, how it does not cut in favor of Hammond here when they talk about in determining the scope of an ADR clause. We're going to look at the factual allegations that are pled and the core of the factual allegations rather than the legal label that's attached to it. Why should we not apply that same reason and say that in examining the claim filed here, whether it was in fact a claim filed, we're going to look at the core factual allegations rather than the legal label that Hammond later put on them in a judicial complaint?
Because I believe that that would contravene the party's contract, Your Honor, which does require that the legal basis be set forth. And it also, I think you have to look beyond Hammond's claim package too. As I mentioned, the project engineer and RTD issued decisions in this matter specifically referencing a differing site condition claim under Standard Specification 104.02, and Hammond didn't object to those decisions because 105.17b requires exhaustion of the claim, not just submission of the claim initially.
So it's your view that in the court, they should have said, we're here on a site discrepancy claim. That's it. That's all I have to say.
We have a differing site condition claim, and they could almost attach their claim package and state, here is our
claim. And that, in your view, would state a claim upon which relief could be granted by the courts?
Well, I think the complaint would probably need a little more. We need to flesh out the actual elements.
Elements of a site claim,
of a differing site condition claim. No. It would be those elements set forth in URS.
And just so I understand, a site claim, and I'm far from expert in this, so help me out. A site claim is, I understood you say, claim for equitable adjustment. Is that what it is?
That's right.
But then count three, they pled equitable
yes.
adjustment.
Yeah,
and
yes,
I thought
right.
your motion dismissed conceded that they had raised an equitable adjustment claim, too.
That's correct, Your Honor. CDOT's first motion to dismiss the equitable adjustment claim, because a differing site condition claim can be an equitable adjustment claim, did not seek to dismiss that claim under Rule 12b-1. It sought to dismiss it under Rule 12b-5. And because that motion was brought pursuant to 12b-5, it was brought prior to discovery into the basis of that claim. However, the moment the case was at issue, CDOT issued interrogatories into the basis of that claim, and Hammond responded that it was one for an alteration of contract. CDOT then filed a second motion to dismiss, basically stating that their equitable adjustment claim was not the same as the differing site condition claim passed through ADR. And in response, Hammond stated that its differing site condition claim and ADR and its equitable adjustment claim were based on separate conduct, essentially admitting CDOT's motion. And the trial court, in its second order, specifically references Hammond's interrogatory responses as well as Hammond's response to that motion in ruling that its equitable adjustment claim in litigation and its equitable adjustment claim in ADR were different. One was for a differing site condition, and one was for alteration of contract.
And we have notice pleading in court. This is not an appeal from the ADR. This is a separate action, is it not?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay, it's not a review of the ADR. So why aren't you on notice as to the nature and scope and the evidence and the facts and all the rest about these claims?
Under notice pleading, as I understand it, a complaint must provide reasonable notice of the basis of the party's claim. And the complaint here doesn't mention a differing site condition. In fact, at deposition, Hammond's trial counsel stated that its claims in ADR in litigation were different. And they've never submitted any evidence to contradict that statement.
Thank you, Mr. Spear.
Yeah, thank you.
Let me just address first off that last, I'll try to take these in roughly reverse order. With regard to the supposed deposition admission, as was indicated in our reply brief, there was no admission in the case. There was an objection raised. Hammond's trial counsel said that this might relate to one claim, might relate to another. Discovery continued. He lodged an objection. There was never any admission that this was a different claim. Now, as Judge Connolly inquired as to whether this was one claim, this absolutely was one single claim here. There were different legal theories. There's several different rationales as to why Hammond is due to be paid for the work it performed. But there's one claim. It's for the 271,000, whatever the number is, that it, in additional expenses that Hammond incurred to remove this rock with rippers from the job site. They are identical fact issues. Matter of proof is essentially the same. It's one claim here, in which Hammond is due under several different, again, legal theories. Now, with regard to the differing site condition, I think both parties would agree that that is somewhat of a term of art in the federal contracting world, and that it's sometimes referred to as equitable adjustment. But that I believe that name is somewhat of a misnomer, because this is not an equitable claim in the sense of equity as would apply to quantum merit or an unjust enrichment. This is still a claim relating to the contract. And that was, as Hammond pointed out, in opposition to the second motion for dismissal or summary judgment. The differing site condition claim alleges a breach of contract. It's not seeking to bring in equity to reform the contract or otherwise apply relief in the absence of a contract. Under the differing site condition clause, CDOT is required to pay for materially different site conditions. CDOT's refusal to pay is a breach of the contract, and Hammond's claim sounds in contract, not in equity, notwithstanding the common term of art of equitable adjustment, which again I think comes from the fact that
What's the difference between equitable adjustment and quantum merit?
Well, quantum merit would apply if there was no contract. For example, if there was no differing site condition claim here, Hammond could bring.
I just wrote a case several years ago that I should say just. I wrote a case several years ago that allowed quantum merit where there was a contract, where the site conditions were not as advertised, for lack of a better term, and the contractor, who happened to be an earth mover, had to do work beyond the scope of his contract and was told to do so.
Right. I believe that would be a traditional quantum merit situation.
What's the difference between that and this?
Well, here there's a specific contract provision that says if you encounter work beyond the scope of your bid, you have to do the work and we will pay you for it later.
Well, you played on just enrichment. Is that an equitable claim?
That is an alternative claim. And I would say that is a claim that sounds in equity. And they were brought in the alternative here, as Hammond was allowed to do. But again, it's essentially one claim that was all set forth. Opposing counsel cited the M.A. D'Atley case, which I believe we included in our reply brief, Hammond's reply brief. The case appears at 71 Federal Claims Reporter 370. That in particular, although it's not addressing a Colorado dispute, makes very clear that in a federal proceeding, you may bring both a breach of contract and a differing site condition claim, and the two are not mutually exclusive, even if there are some technical distinctions between the two. Would also like to respond.
What is our standard of review here?
It is de novo. As to the motion to dismiss. And again, had there been a hearing, there might have been a mixed standard of review or an alternate standard of review. But here, Hammond's requests for a hearing were denied. And as such, under the Medina versus State decision, the standard of review is de novo, which is conceded in CDOT's answer brief. The other final point I'd like to note on is that there were some questions about how the claim should be presented to an engineer, and I believe Judge Roy asked why an engineer wouldn't just disregard some of the legalese. That is essentially what we believe happened here. Hammond complied with his contract. It submitted a full claim package that identified the specific federal cases, state cases that gave rise to its claim for breach of contract. The engineer didn't respond to those. And it is not true that Hammond didn't object. Hammond continually reasserted that it had a breach of contract claim here. The engineer, however, chose to view it only as a differing site condition claim. And my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. That completes our docket for the morning. The court will be in recess. The bailiff may so announce.
All rise.